Tell me about a complicated man. Muse, tell me how he wandered and was lost when he had wrecked the holy town of Troy, and where he went, and who he met, the pain he suffered on the sea, and how he worked to save his life and bring his men back home. He failed, and for their own mistakes, they died. They ate the sun god's cattle, and the god kept them from home. Now, goddess, child of Zeus, tell the old story for our modern times. Find the beginning.
Are you reading my new LinkedIn bio?
Today, we're reading the Odyssey. Or, I guess we've already read the Odyssey, but now we are embarking on a different odyssey of trying to reconstruct the weather 3,000 years ago with the help of a paper, an academic paper, called Meteorological Assessment of Homer's Odyssey. It's from the 90s, but it is so good, and I'm so excited to talk about this just because the process of reconstructing weather from that long ago is so interesting.
Yeah, it's almost like reading its own little mystery of like piecing together the, you know, the cork board with yarn. I'm like, well, okay, if Menelaus was over here. Yeah, it's, I would say this is the most fun paper we've read. And before we lose you, because you only like AI, you sicko listener. This paper is excellent, and I really think you will enjoy it. And, you know, to our point about where does the end end and where does the end begin, apparently the end begins with end-to-end data in 1200 BC, potentially.
Yeah. Well, I think, like, maybe one of the most fundamental questions that we're going to tackle on today's episode is, if you need observations that are outside of the historical record, what do you do? Where do you go? They might be found in epic poems.
I dream about the day that someone is sitting in their office in front of their computer and they're like, this AI model over the Mediterranean Sea just won't get this microburst right. And this, like, the Rosetta Stone, the, like, missing piece that, like, unlocks AI speaking in the language of weather is this one event from pre-recorded time. It's not going to happen, but it's a lovely vision. I think we should, I want to just read the abstract. Yeah. Just to hook the reader, and then let's catch people back up on the Odyssey, because unlike us, they may not have read it last week.
Uncultured.
Yeah.
The hoi polloi. Talk about the hoi polloi.
So this is a meteorological assessment of Homer's Odyssey. Abstract. A chronology of the meteorological events described by Homer in the Odyssey following the Achaeans' conquest of Troy is developed. Application of polar front theory to the voyages of six separate fleets as they sailed from Troy provides a unique test of the factual nature of a portion of the epic. Nothing beyond the limits of accepted meteorological theory occurred during the first 18 days following the departure from Troy. The Odyssey consistently shows a credible set of weather observations. Evidence suggests that the tragedies experienced by the Achaeans in the Odyssey may have been caused by a cyclonic storm crossing the area in the early summer. If the Achaeans' initial travels after the conquest of Troy are factual, the chronology developed in this study extends our knowledge of daily weather events to an earlier time than has previously been available and creates a new component in the global history of climate and weather. A description in the Odyssey of a possible microburst event is also presented. Crazy. Crazy. We'll go through the paper after we kind of recap some of the context from the Odyssey. Also, I will say, this paper's from 93. There may be, I didn't see any obvious rebuttals, or like maybe there are things that say this is full of shit. I don't know. But we'll take this in its own little sandbox in isolation as a work.
In my cursory research, that was one Google search that read, did the weather in the Odyssey actually happen? This was the most credible source I could find.
Yeah, it was published in American Meteorological Society.
If you have not read the Odyssey since you were 14 and in high school, it begins actually not with Odysseus. It begins with Odysseus's son back in Ithaca, where Odysseus has left more than a decade ago when the story does start. He's gone to fight in the Trojan War, and he's been lost at sea for like 12 years. It begins in media res, in the middle of things, as many epic poems do. And Telemachus is trying to understand what has happened to his father. All of these suitors have come to marry his mother because you can't just be like a single and famous woman.
God forbid.
Yeah. No, literally. If it's not the god's will, it won't happen. But this is important just because Telemachus, in trying to like understand if he should keep waiting around for his father or if he should allow one of these suitors to marry his mother, he goes to some of Odysseus's cohort in war. I never know what to call these people, but other warriors. He talks to Nestor and Agamemnon.
Colleagues, co-workers.
And he essentially asks them, like, what happened? When you all were sailing back from Troy, what happened? Why did you come back and why didn't my father come back? We get a few different perspectives of the storm system that came through and knocked the different fleets off course. And that becomes the kind of the most important piece that the paper then uses to reconstruct the sort of meteorological event that took place in the Odyssey and is detailed in the book. In book 5, that we actually get to meet Odysseus and we actually get to hear the story from him. But in typical like Odyssey fashion, it's not straightforward. Book 5 also is in the middle of things. He's already been at sea for 10 years. He washes up on a new land with a nice king who takes pity on Odysseus. Well, Odysseus endears himself. That's one of Odysseus's like key traits, is he's kind of this like smooth talker. So he endears himself to this king, but before he gets to be sent on his way back to Ithaca, they ask him to tell his story. So the true telling of the Odyssey happens much later in the book. So Odysseus's account comes like in book 9. So between all those accounts that we have back in book 4, and then Odysseus's retelling of his own experience, the paper is able to like go in, create, or just reconstruct the storm system that knocked them all off course.
Section 1 is Where's My Daddy? Section 2 is Daddy's Tale. And section 3 is Daddy's Home. That's how I think of it. And I still envy, I think I read it in 7th grade, which actually blows my mind because this is way too sexy of a tale for a 7th grader.
Okay, yeah. My partner is a high school teacher and he just taught the Odyssey to his students. And one of the, we can cut this out, but it's kind of crazy. They read like the graphic novel version. And when they're on like Calypso, when Odysseus is on Calypso's island, you know, and it's like essentially just like an NC-17 movie or something.
Yeah, I believe.
I think Garth like asked the students, like, what would you do in this situation? And one of the guys, like one of the young boys, raises his hand and is like, I'd stay for another 7 years.
One thing that I love about just the Odyssey, just for a second before we dive through, is this meta-narrative. I'm a big meta-narrative fan of stories within stories within stories. You know, Borges is, Maru and I talk a lot about Borges, and most of the sci-fi I like because you're reading it, it's this weird world, and then someone starts telling a story within that world, and then in that story is another story. I just love that. I eat that stuff up. And what you have in the Odyssey is this onion of stories. You have the narrator, who ostensibly is a poet, an orator, so a storyteller is telling the story out loud to an audience. Then you have Homer, who's collected that maybe across one telling, maybe across many, collecting the best parts in a book. Or maybe Homer, like Shakespeare, is like a cabal of a million poets, who knows. Then you have, within the written text, a narrator who upfront tells you what's going to happen, and then the story unfolds. You have Telemachus's perspective, then you shift to Odysseus's, and then Odysseus retells his own story. And it's just pretty incredible that this paper can sift through that. And it goes into so much detail. We'll get to it, but it's just like so cool how it's able to take this, you know, these different kind of levels of opacity of like, okay, is this a reliable narrator? Is it not? Like, how am I moving through this story at any given point? And reconstructs like basically a travel itinerary of everyone with like daily, almost daily precision. There's one line later that we'll get to that just makes me laugh out loud when it reaches its conclusion after this analysis of like when this weather event happened. But yeah, the Odyssey, I've told Marta this many times at this point, but it is a good book. And I think the narrative structure itself is what makes it such a good book. It has a very, very unique interplay of like suspense, but it tells you what's going to happen, but it's still suspenseful, but you know what's going to unfold, and it has this loop. It's pretty wonderful.
Yeah, and I mean, that remains true, like reading it 3,000 years after the fact, where it's so cemented like in our cultural consciousness, and most people know what it's about, but it still remains a really great story. I can't imagine how electric it would have been being like a contemporary and hearing this from a bard.
Oh my God. All the other stories probably sucked. They're probably like, oh yeah, and then the wheat didn't grow. And then this is like, well, Odysseus has kicked everyone's ass.
I mean, or even like, no shade to the Iliad, but not as good.
Yeah. I almost forgot, don't we have a Christopher Nolan retelling coming out soon?
Yeah, okay. Summer 2027, everyone's got a year and some change to go read the Odyssey. I'm actually really fast. Like, I'm really interested to see how they're going to handle like the first half versus the second half of the book. Like, if the focus will be on the actual sailing of the seas and contending with the weather, because I think the CGI cyclonic system could be pretty sick.
I'll work through my network to get in touch with Christopher and see what his thoughts are. I want to make sure before production gets too far that they work in the microbrush properly.
Yeah, definitely. That's non-negotiable.
So the introduction starts by talking about how historic voyages, whether it's like a pilgrimage or probably seafaring, those are really useful for reconstructing historical weather events. And it cites a couple papers who have done this. But what's interesting is a lot of those reconstructions are point-based, right? It's like one pilgrimage or one ship going west. And you get this like point observation and what happened to that one ship. What's interesting in this case is you have this dispersion of Odysseus and all of his companions kind of in different directions. And so what that allows you to do is create this spatial and temporal gradient of what's occurring to each of those perspectives. It's kind of amazing that that dispersion happened, and then somehow if these events occurred, that they somehow then got recollected into a single perspective. You basically, I was joking to Marta, it's almost like you have buoys thrown into the Mediterranean. They're swept off into different directions, and then we're getting retold the story from the perspective of each of those buoys. And from that, we can reconstruct sort of what happened with this weather pattern, not just point observation, but as a gradient.
I'll say too, like the paper itself does, I think, a lot of work. It's actually so impressive that the actual weather events, like if you think of like the precipitation or the wind, like that's only one piece of it. It also does a lot of work with understanding geographically where the fleets were in space, and then backs its way into what time of year that could have possibly happened. So it's really doing like a due diligence to understand the entire system.
Yeah. There's a section I really like. As researchers now date the historical events chronicled by the ancient Greek poet to approximately 1200 BC, extraction of daily weather data for this period may be particularly useful to atmospheric scientists, both as an extension of our knowledge of daily weather events to an earlier time than has previously been available, and as a new component in a global reconstruction of climate and weather. Additionally, the application of meteorological knowledge to the Odyssey provides a unique test of the validity of a portion of this ancient epic. So it's bidirectional. It's not only can we extract what happened with weather, but does the way the weather describe in some way lend credibility to the story itself?
Yeah.
And that is the coolest part to me.
It kind of reminds me of like looking at how accurate like a model is, like especially the ones that are climate models and are just super, super far, hundreds of years into the future, and essentially looking at are the weather events that they're predicting, like, do they look kind of real? Could this be something that is actually like going to happen? There's so many like echoes with the approach of looking back and reconstructing weather events, as well as like forecasting future weather events. Do we want to talk about the caveats that it states before we get into the sort of day-by-day narrative?
Yeah.
Do you want to
just First of all, no way to know if the Odyssey is real or not. It cites a paper that says, don't dismiss the story just because it's told as if it's fiction. It says that it was not created as a weather logbook, so it should not be treated as such.
I think the other caveat that I actually found a little bit, if there was a place to push back on this paper, I think this might be where I would do it. The paper's stance is that this era of ancient Greece was not particularly advanced with their understanding of Earth systems. And I think in the grand scheme of things, that's true. Like, there are definitely other ancient civilizations that were more advanced than the ancient Greeks.
But it talks about it as a body of science. And I found that ick maybe outdated, but like I have a book about Polynesian cultures that date way further back than this, I believe, that were using forecasting and understanding how water changes and stuff.
So. I mean, like Babylonians and the Sumerians, there's so many actually like civilizations that predate ancient Greek that were actually more advanced. And just because of the nature of being more isolated, I think it's fair to say those ideas wouldn't necessarily be shared cross-culturally. Yeah. But I think that they point to the Greeks, I guess, understanding of all weather as being connected to the gods as sort of evidence for how they're not advanced. But I think there's quite a few places where the paper actually contradicts itself. When they go into the chronology of events, they start to do some, I think, very like charitable understanding of like why one of the fleets would have stayed an extra day. Was it because they were waiting for God's will, or did they have some kind of intuition that if they wait a day, the winds might change? The sea conditions in response to the winds might change. Like, I think that there are quite a few places that suggest a bit more like systems thinking.
Yeah. And maybe as a storytelling, you want these figures, these godlike figures, to seem like they're God-fearing figures. So waiting a extra day because the wind looks like shit and calling it, you know, bowing to Zeus or Poseidon, it might be masked in storytelling.
Yeah, and I think even just by nature of Poseidon being both the god of the sea and the god of earthquakes, there are some sort of interesting connections I feel like the Greeks were making, maybe more connected than totally divine random events from the gods.
Yeah. Let's get into the timeline. Mm-hmm. A chronology may be constructed because of the non-meteorological nature of the source material. Portions of the reconstruction must be made by conjecture and logic rather than by direct evidence. So keep that in mind. That's kind of what makes it a fun little forensics detective paper. It's going to use, they use the translation by Mandelbaum, 1990. Okay, so day one. We're on day one. You ready?
Yeah.
The first day, the first day's journey is best related by Nestor of Pylos in book three. He stated that initially half of the Achaeans stayed at Troy with Agamemnon to conduct rites to appease the goddess Athena. After an argument, the other half, including Nestor, Menelaus, Odysseus, and Diomedes, at daybreak launched our ships across the glowing sea and landed at the nearby island of Tenedos. A debate followed at Tenedos regarding whether to return to Troy or continue to Greece. Nestor and Diomedes convinced their respective fleets to proceed to Lesbos. The weather conditions during the trip were calm and uneventful. A clement god had smoothed the sea's rough surface. So already it's kind of cool, right? We're like taking this poem and we have a map and we're drawing little dotted lines as we move across the map.
I think like it sort of sets the stage essentially for why the fleets broke up in the first place. The seas were calm and the Achaeans were sort of famously not seafaring people. So this is actually, I think, one of my favorite parts of the paper is just the understanding of culture and why they're making the decisions that they're making. And they generally, when it came to like crossing open water, the Achaeans were very risk averse. So they'd always prioritize a safe crossing over getting there really fast. So it sort of like sets up the decision that is ultimately made and answers a question that I think the book maybe leaves open-ended, why these people went different routes in the first place.
And so first conjecture, it's like, maybe Odysseus went back. Because Odysseus returns to Troy. Maybe Odysseus went back because of generally weak winds that Nestor notes. Like, you couldn't get to where they were trying to go unless there were northerly or northeasterly winds. So this is the first, like, I guess, forensic leap, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, but the book says that Odysseus returns to help Agamemnon, one of his colleagues in war, with funeral rites, which like in this culture would have been such a noble thing to do. They take their funerals very seriously. So, I mean, that's just sort of like an interesting thing. Like, you know, if he's a pragmatist, he's returning because there's not winds. And the paper can do that bit of like connecting the dots for us.
Yeah.
But that's not on the page in the actual book.
Day two. Homer implies that the winds have begun to increase when he states that Menelaus overtook Nestor at the island of Lesbos, although Menelaus started later than his two fellow Achaeans in leaving Tenedos. Okay, so this is less of a leap, right? Someone overtakes people, you can kind of say, unless they're... They do talk a lot about, like, rowing hard, but maybe it's the wind. The analysis that the paper does of the first 2 days is talking basically about wind conditions. Why are they taking the route that is described in the narrative and trying to kind of reverse that out to, all right, the winds are acting strangely?
Yeah. I mean, I think most simply stated is that the seas were so calm in those first few days, they couldn't cross quickly. And so should we dive into, get to day four?
Sure. I'll just say on day three, it notes that a shrill wind started up. The ships ran swiftly across the seaways rich with fish. That night we landed at Gerastus. I don't know. But the paper notes that is like ripping fast. Okay. So that's only possible if there's really starting to be some wind coming in. So we start with some maybe weird shifting wind, some calmness, and now on day three, ripping wind, moving fast. Day four. So a couple days pass, we get to day five. The crews have separated slightly in the sea. you know, for normal reasons, like a quick pillage or burying a dead comrade.
Yeah.
So we have Menelaus completing funeral rites. We have Odysseus burying some buddies who died in that quick pillage.
Yeah.
And we have Nestor, who's probably safe because he lived closer.
Yeah, he gets home.
He gets home. And then what it's positing is that we have things picking up in terms of a cold front moving in.
Yeah. Like the speed that gets Nestor home early is a cold front. And it's likely the beginning of this storm system that kind of undoes the other fleets that are still on the sea.
So then we have Homer say, the god Zeus poured shrill blasts and swollen combers, mountainous and vast, down on the Achaean king's ships. So Menelaus's fleet was split and separated in the storm. And so you have Ajax and Menelaus split up here. And actually, there's what's cool is that the paper references the sailing directions for Eastern Mediterranean by the Defense Mapping Agency in 1992. Violent squalls occur frequently near the Acra Cape Malleus, spilling over from the high mountains above. So it's trying to, I guess, take the description in the book and corroborate it with some modern guidance of like sea navigation in this area. So the fleets of Agamemnon and Ajax separated. Ajax's homeland of Leucadia?
Yeah.
Hell. Of Leucadia lay to the north, across from the northwest tip of Euboea.
That's one I
figured all this shit out.
That one I don't know at all. Like, I actually looked that one up and I still couldn't.
Conversely, Agamemnon's kingdom lay westward. So you basically, they're going in the same general direction. They're about to split up a little bit. They hit this storm. They get separated. And both fleets are encountering severe weather.
Day six is where this sort of massive, like, cyclonic system really kicks up. And yeah. Odysseus's retelling of his voyage notes that Boreas, which is the north wind, provoked by Zeus, who summons clouds, now swept against us, a ferocious tempest wrapped both land and sea, night scudded down from heavens. This is like the storm in the Odyssey that sends Odysseus like totally off track. And because of where Odysseus is on the Aegean Sea, he kind of gets like the brunt of this system. We finally kind of arrive to, in some way, like the conclusion of what's actually happening here. Like, we sort of start to understand like what kind of system is coming through. So the paper says, it would therefore appear that a reasonable chronology of the six major Achaean fleets departing Troy produces a major cyclonic system passing through the Aegean Sea 6 days after the Achaeans' departure.
So basically, you get to day six, we have Nestor. He's fine. He's home. You've got Menelaus hitting a storm. Odysseus hitting a storm south from Ismarus. You got Agamemnon hitting a storm near Cape Malea. You've got Ajax dashed against the rocks of Gyrae, which is known now as the Grave of Ajax or something. So you have these different like point observations. They're each reporting like different directions of wind. And from that, the paper starts to tease out what's going on across the Mediterranean. So this is, I guess it's like a multi-day storm.
Yeah,
it is. It's really ripping now by day nine. Odysseus says, Homer says, that Odysseus says, we stepped our masts and set white sails, then sat. The wind and helms kept up on our path. I would have reached my Ithaca intact if, as I rounded Cape Malea, combers and currents had not joined with the Boreas north wind and driven me off course beyond Kythera. So The paper says, it's important to note here that Homer does not specifically mention a storm, but rather large waves and strong northerly winds. It's likely that Odysseus and his men did not experience a storm as they attempted to round Cape Malea. Instead, the strong, persistent northerly wind created a turbulent sea.
By day 9, the storm itself has moved through the area, but the sea remains pretty choppy. And that area, Cape Malea, is still, like, to this day known for its strong. So in trying to round that, it's sort of like this perfect storm in a lot of ways for Odysseus in particular. He just gets bad luck. Like, throughout these first 18 days, if he had not stayed for funeral rites, like, here and there, if he had actually been able to get to where he is on day 9 by day 6, like, he would have been fine. But it's rounding that Cape Malea that really is, like, sends him off.
My theory is that Odysseus was actually gone for just, like, 20 days, and they call it 20 years.
Probably. It was probably enough for everyone back home to be like, he's dead. And then when he's not dead, they're like, he's the hero. And the story begins from there.
Yeah. Okay, so can we recap it?
Yeah, totally.
So I'm thinking, like, what the paper does is it is looking through the events of the Achaean armies returning home on their little dinghy rafts with square sails, and it tries to reconstruct a storm through a lot of inference, but through, I think, grounded in some, like, you know, educated hypothesis on why they would be making certain decisions. So you have a couple people make it home fine. And those are the people who are traveling short routes to in a certain direction where they probably wouldn't have hit the storm. You have the rest of them start to get really bad winds. They take a quick break to do some pillaging, burying their buddies who die in the pillaging, burying a guy who just dies, you know, peacefully. Agamemnon. Is it Menelaus? Menelaus buries his navigator or something.
Yeah, his helmsman.
And they take a long, when they do burials, they take a long time. Partying, feasting, celebrating the life, the great life of their navigator.
Takes at least a day.
At least one day is what the paper says. And so from this, the paper does a couple of things. It constructs this, like, timetable, which is pretty sick, for each of Nestor, Menelaus, Odysseus, Agamemnon, Ajax, etc. And it's like day 1, weather, calm. The location. Day 2, weather, unknown location. Day 3, northeast wind. And it's like basing those observations on little tidbits from Homer, which is really cool. You have, I think most notably, Menelaus and Ajax are going in the same general direction and they hit trouble.
Yeah. I think it's maybe most important to note that Agamemnon and Ajax, essentially everyone except for Odysseus, goes generally south. Some of them make it home, some of them hit a storm and then get blown off to Egypt. But when they leave Troy, Odysseus decides to head north. Odysseus's path, that is so different from the others, slows him down. So by the time he's coming around what in the book is called Cape Malea and is today still known as, like, a very stormy place, Odysseus is kind of trapped. He can't make a safe crossing. They're famously not good at sailing. And that's really where Odysseus gets blown off course.
I love this one. This one part made me laugh. Homer makes no mention of the season associated with this portion of the Odyssey. The greatest likelihood is the early summer, specifically the month of June. And I just thought that was hilarious because this whole paper is, like, really cleverly grasping at straws.
Well, I mean, they do some work to get there, though.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk about the work.
The first point, they kind of have, like, two pieces of evidence for their June hypothesis. But the first one is the typical sailing season for the early Greeks was for a period of 50 days following the solstice. And that information comes from Hesiod, Works and Days, which is, I mean, I think it's just awesome that they go and sort of pull from other really foundational works. And Works and Days is actually maybe closer to a weather log than the Odyssey. It's kind of considered like the ancient Greek farmer's almanac. So I think that that's just like a cool place to look, to start like backing into what this timeline is. The other sort of piece of evidence that they use is also just by understanding, I think they're called the Etesian winds. I'm not sure how to pronounce that, but the Etesian winds of July and August are associated with dry conditions. And then they look to modern climatology. So they essentially look backward and reference Hesiod, and then they look at today's climate and sort of piece together what might be a seasonally appropriate thing.
Yeah, it's pretty great logicking through there.
I guess they also do say those two pieces of evidence are A and B, and then they have C hidden down at the bottom. They say, or C, the storm was an anomaly.
Yeah, right. Which, yeah, there are anomalies. That's the whole...
Totally.
Whole nature of climate.
Well, I think that the period of climate change that starts to happen, like, kind of toward the end of the Homeric period is one of the, I think, most pointed to pieces of evidence for the fall of a lot of the, like, Greek Empire, and essentially for, like, this agrarian crisis that was happening throughout ancient Greek. So I think it makes sense that they're aware of it. And I think also, if we're going to kind of consider anomalies as a possibility, like if we're at the beginning of the sort of shifting climate, maybe the winds are acting in ways that they don't expect, or maybe they don't understand like this system that they're working in. Their like typical sailing season isn't holding up.
Even if it's anomalous, the says no event that modern science, no event that modern scientists would classify as supernatural or miraculous occurred during the 18 days following the departure from Troy. So this isn't an impossible set of storm events. And it says, rather, the Odyssey shows a remarkably credible set of weather observations. While this analysis does not answer the question of the Odyssey's historical accuracy, it does show a consistency in descriptions of weather events and ship movements that is likely beyond coincidence. Which is, that is my, of the paper, that is my favorite part. Because so far we've been looking at it like, oh, what is the weather happening? Can we reconstruct weather? And it's saying, well, from what we're, from the general patterns, it's beyond coincidence that some bard just kind of threw these events together. It's too specific. It's too specific about delays and wind directions. And it is surprisingly, as you read it, it's surprisingly specific about some things.
Go ahead. And I think what's also kind of fascinating is like there are a lot of ways to go back and try to validify an ancient piece of literature or like a myth and see if there's any sort of, you know, evidence for these things. And I think there's been a ton of campaigns, like archaeological efforts to sort of, can we go to this place where we think Odysseus or one of the other fleets shipwrecked and see if we can find some archaeological evidence? And generally, to my understanding, that has not been found. But this, I think, does kind of hold up, which there's a lot of other maybe like cultural sort of vestiges and the way that the story has like persisted that also points to it being real in some way, but to me this feels like something akin to archaeology, like being able to say actually all that did happen here from a meteorological standpoint does make sense. Like it does feel like evidence similar to finding a shipwreck.
Yeah, and there's something so poetic and kind of in Marta and Mai's spirit here of like story as data, right? And that's why this is so cool. The paper makes one more Hail Mary that I want to just throw out. It may be possible to interpret an episode near the saga's end in the light of an only recently defined meteorological phenomenon, a microburst, you know, in the 90s, early 90s. That said, he, Poseidon, massed the clouds, and he gripped his trident, whipped the surge, and urged all winds to blow at will. Eurus, the east wind, Notus, the south wind, and voracious Zephyr, the west wind, and Boreas, the north wind, who's born in the bright ether, attacked together. The force of all winds crushed me. Microburst, right? Hashtag microburst. Is this the first recorded description of a microburst? Hell yeah, maybe.
Yeah. And then they go on to look at the mountains around the northern Mediterranean where this would have been taking place. And they say that area often creates downdrafts dangerous to the sailors of square-sailed vessels. Yeah. So
I'm going to read the last paragraph because I like it. Homer constructed his epic poetry of the fall of Troy for the people of his time. Yet his epic, his slash her slash their epic, has continued to inspire people to the modern day. This study suggests that even 3,000 years after its first telling, additional useful and interesting knowledge regarding the world of Homer's day may still be uncovered from this classical epic. I guess Emily Wilson, the translator we read, was like, yeah, Homer's probably a dude.
Yeah, I think that's generally what's accepted.
Yeah, it's too bro-y.
Yeah, but I do love the sentiment here. Like, there's a lot of interesting and useful knowledge, but I would say it's probably beyond just like interesting and useful. I think that it's maybe very important even. And I feel like the spirit of the paper and like the place where it ends feels very in line with that first line that I read from the actual book. Now, goddess, child of Zeus, tell the old story for our modern times. So yeah. I feel like that was, I don't know, like the question that I kept coming back to as I was reading, beyond just having a literal or possibly literal historical record, like what else do we stand to gain from looking at the Odyssey as evidence, as real? What do we have like to gain from reading the classics generally? Do you have thoughts about that?
I don't know. I mean, I think the older the story, if it's still kicking, it's got something to it. Any text that lasts more than 100 years is a classic, right? And there has to be wisdom that's keeping it around. It can't be, the Odyssey is not just like pure entertainment. There's something there about storytelling, the narrative structure, this kind of like record that keeps it around. And so I'm not qualified to say, to answer your question, Marta, if there's any like value.
No, I mean, I think that's like...
Book. We like books. I'm going to re-answer your question.
Okay.
I think there's an interesting question that is posed to the modern day weather people when we, if you think about it in the same way as Homer's epic. That storytelling was probably the best mode of packaging up data and preserving it. It's how, you know, everyone wants to be, tell stories about me, sing songs about me. You know, I'm going to like kill as many people as I can in this battle so that you remember me, or do good deeds, or we didn't talk about this, but like be hospitable to visitors. So storytelling is how people preserve their legacy. I think a lot about data products and archiving data, archiving forecasts. How do we look back and understand what we were looking at when we made a decision? And what I don't think there's a good answer for is extreme long-term preservation. Got a bunch of hard drives around me. They're all gonna break. Like, what is the way at modern scale to preserve stuff? I remember reading The Three Body Problem. Did you ever read that?
I haven't read that.
Yeah, you might like it. It's a little... Anyway, there's this whole thing where I think they send to Pluto discs with etchings on the disc as like long-term preservation, like a record almost. If Homer is the like first crack at data preservation, what is the modern day, like what's going to last 4,000 years from now in terms of preserving knowledge? Is it just kind of like this changing of hands, sort of like the modern bard is the person who picks up a piece of data, decides to archive it in a new format. Someone's going to pick that up and retell it. Someone's going to pick that up and retell it. Or is there something that like is going to last as long as a book?
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of interesting because on one hand, we have so many more tools for that kind of preservation. Like we have so many more technologies designed to do that. But I think it's actually much harder to do that preservation, thinking about in terms of like cultural consciousness, like in order to cement a story in a way that it creates a narrative and it creates a culture and creates a common shared memory, you have to harness attention and it has to last. And I think that's kind of the thing that our modern world is deficit in. On one hand, it makes my heart so happy to know that this kind of data preservation from the Odyssey has persisted 3,000 years later. I don't know if I can look at that and say, oh, I now feel hopeful our stories now will persist in the same way. Our stories being written now. Yeah. I think I want to retain that hope in humanity. So I'm going to, but I want to recognize that I think we're up against new problems.
Wow.
The other thing that I think about when it comes to reading the classics and why we read the classics, and this feels especially relevant because I think I was a person who hated the Odyssey and didn't want to read it. And I think that comes from thinking of it as this story that does have quite a few problematic elements by today's moral standards, but it's also just so exemplary, or I guess it represents what is the Western canon in a lot of ways. Like, it foregrounds white male perspectives. And I think by the time I was in college and really understanding how literature can impact a mind, I was such a disciple of Toni Morrison and Octavia Butler and James Baldwin that, I wanted to, live out that interest and read beyond what we think of as the Western canon. So I was sort of this person that was I don't think you need to read the classics. But later on, I did meet a professor that I had in grad school that was, in a way, just so such a free thinker, and I think one of the most critical people I've ever met. The way that she framed the importance of reading the classics is just by virtue of being alive right now, you are a contemporary. Your mind is shaped and of this moment in time and this moment in culture. And the only way to break out of that is to read forward and back. So by reading the classics, you are truly engaging with a perspective that is outside of this time. So I think when we ask ourselves, how do we innovate? How can we really tap into some sort of true creativity or something that feels really new? I do think that reading the classics is one avenue into innovation as well. Look back to go forward. I think that's what I'm trying to say.
You should do your own podcast where it's just you talking the whole time.